So everything I just said will not be on the recording that I post for this lecture because I forgot to turn it on. However, we're starting the physics part of it now. So if you remember, last time we were talking about electric field calculations. And for electric fields, remember, it's the force per unit charge. The force, I hope you recall, is kqq over r squared, would be the force between two charges. The force per unit charge divides out one of those charges. So it divides out the charge, which would be at the point where you want to figure out the electric field. So you can calculate the force by taking the electric field at that point and multiplying it by the magnitude of whatever charge you would pop there. So you can do that. So the electric field at some point, if you have discrete charges, goes as kq, where these are each of the discrete charges. You're summing over the q sub i's. And the q sub i's are given by some vector r sub i relative to the point p. So it's the vector sum of this kq over r squared. And that would give you the electric field. Most of the time you end up with continuous distributions of some form, and life is a little harder because you don't really have the discrete charges. So what you do is you step back for a moment and you invent a discrete charge. This is the point of calculus. If you didn't learn it in calculus, they're pretty good at not actually explaining why you're doing it when they're teaching you how to do it. You invent a point charge here in this continuous distribution. It's a little tiny thing, and it has to be a little tiny because stuff is changing in that distribution, and you don't know how to handle that. But if I take a piece of it that is small enough, then I can consider it discrete, and I know how to handle it. So now, I can ask, what is the field at this point due to that dq? And it is exactly this, where now instead of a real discrete q, I use this dq. So that's what goes here. And then instead of a sum, I have to add an infinite number of these little dq's to go through that whole continuous region, and that's what we know as an integral. Okay, so you integrate over this volume, this quantity. It can be doable by mere mortals. You are expected to be able to do certain geometries, I guess, and you will get practice at those. We did an example last time. It can be arbitrarily difficult because this dq is a rho dv, where rho is a charge distribution as a function of where you are. That's what this little r hat is, this r vector is. And this rho could be some mathematical expression that some jerk puts in the problem. It could be nasty. This direction is changing, so depending on where p is and what the symmetry is and where this volume is, this vector can be arbitrarily strange. Okay, so it can make this very hard, and you always have this r squared in the bottom, and the magnitude of this is changing as you go. So this can be really, really bad. Or it might not be so bad, depending on the geometry specifically. So we did one example last time, which was a doable example. And in that case, we looked at the electric field at a point P above the midpoint of a line distribution which had a constant charge per unit length along the line. And we took advantage of symmetry in order to do this problem. And very often in these types of problems, you'll want to look and try to think your way through the symmetry as to what's going on, because very often you can tell what the direction of the electric field is going to be just from looking at it. And with that as a constraint, it can really help simplify the math and stuff that you have to do, which is exactly what we did in this case. We noticed that due to the symmetry of this problem, if I have a dq over here and a dq over here, this one gives me this component of electric field, this one gives me this component of electric field. If I picked pieces that are equidistant from the midpoint here, the transverse, the side-to-side components of these two electric field pieces cancel out, and you're left with just the upward component of each of them which adds together. So you constrain the problem to have the electric field in the upward direction. If you analyze the angles, you can actually look at the component in terms of the cosine of the angle that you have for this line going down to the dq that you choose. And so then you can write the expression that we had on the last page, taking into account that you're projecting out the cosine theta component and sum from 0 to L multiplying by 2, so you sort of have that gain. That's what enables you to do that particular problem. Visually, it turns out there's a group at MIT that did a nice applet that shows this in action. In this case, these are the little DQs, and what you see are the little components of DE adding together into a total E. And in this case, they are actually integrating from minus L over to L instead of from 0 to L and multiplying by 2. So hopefully, visually, this helps you see a little bit what you're trying to do with this interval. There's a link on your class website to the MIT Teal applets, it's called. And they have a lot of them that, again, you might have fun playing with. One of the geometries that is doable that you'll be doing in some of the problems and things are rings of charge. Oh, shoot. That's so annoying. Okay. I don't know if it's worth our trouble. You can go look at the ring by the time I get my password in there. Class will be half over. Okay, so the geometry is not always so easy. And sometimes it may be a little deceptive in the sense that it seems like it ought to be easy. So if you have just a simple sphere of charge, and I ask you, what is the electric field outside of the charge? It turns out to be a pretty boring problem to calculate it in the way that I just told you about. It has spherical symmetry, so you're sort of driven to use spherical polar coordinates. If you write a little dv in spherical polar coordinates, it turns out to be a little bit obscene. Depending on what r you are and what angle you are, if you get r squared sine theta, d theta, d phi, dr. So that's sort of nasty. So you end up having to basically do three nested intervals, one over each of the dimensions, to make it work. And it's certifiably nasty, and it can be even nastier because this rho could be a function of where you are. You have the r squares and not the demand put in the direction. So, yeah. Okay, so my friend here is concerned, and most of you should be. And so what I'm going to do now is talk to you about the better way in which you can do calculations. And what we're going to do is talk about a concept called flux. And from this, we're going to extract a very general rule. And that general rule, that general equation, again, it may be a situation where it could be easy, or it might not be so easy. But it turns out that it is easy for several particular geometries that we'll find to be very, very useful. So it's a standard way of calculating the field that is sort of far more common than the kind of stuff that we just did with that line. There are some tricks, so I will try to talk you through the tricks. The stuff that we're heading into right now, the electric field calculation that you're probably got a workshop problem on, some homework problems, this stuff on Gauss, I will just warn you, it is the stuff that I, within the two-semester sequence of 113, 114, if there is a two-week period where the students are walking around looking like they got hit by a truck, this is the stuff. So if you feel like you're getting hit by a truck, take heart in the fact that you're normal. Okay? And go and keep working at it and ask a lot of questions and focus on it, and it does come. It's actually, most of physics is fits this, but this really does fit it, which is when I first look at something, it's very opaque. Okay? It just doesn't necessarily make sense at all. Physics is hard, people say. When you get it, and sometimes that takes a little time and effort, but when you get it, I defy you to describe it more simply than it's already done. Once you get it, it will make sense. So this is a point where you're going to have to work to get it. Many of you, okay? Don't hang the one or two people in your workshop who just seem to get it automatically. Every workshop's got one of those, and that's okay. Maybe they'll help you. So what I want to talk about first is seems like a big change in direction. We're just going to talk about something called electric flux. Okay? And the way to think about electric flux is you imagine that you have something like a surface, like this sheet of paper, okay? And let's humor me and pretend that I'm drawing something like that here that you can visualize, that's sort of perpendicular to the board, so it's like this, okay? And let's imagine that we have some sort of electric field in this region of space. Then we define the flux in this case going through this surface. Let's say that it has an area A. The flux would be the magnitude of that electric field times the area. So the flux is sort of, when you think about it, is how much electric field lines pass through the surface. You can think of it like I have my hand is a screen, and I put it in a stream of water. How much water goes through that stream is sort of a measure of, that would be the water flux, if you want. Okay, so it would be. So that's what the electric field is. Let me draw the surface as if it is truly perpendicular to the plane of the board, so you don't see it, it's just 90 degrees to you. There's a thing about surfaces that you're going to have to get used to here. This surface is different from that surface, which is different from that surface. Right? They're different, they're distinct because their directions are different, their orientations are different. Right? Now, it may seem a little bit odd at first, but the way in which you can define the orientation of a surface is through a single vector that is at right angles to that surface. You have seen it perhaps in rotational motion. If you recall in rotational motion, suppose this is a wheel that is spinning, and you want to calculate the angular momentum. You want to say, what is the angular momentum of the omega vector? Do you remember that? Okay. The omega vector is given, it's along the axis of rotation. If it is this way, then the thing is rotating at right angles to it. So if it's rotating like that, omega is this way. If it's rotating like this, omega is that way. If it's rotating this way, omega is up. If it's rotating that way, omega is down. If it's rotating fast, omega is big. If it's rotating slow, omega is small. Right? So with that one stupid omega, I can describe this really complicated, strange three-dimensional system. So it's really powerful. And it's one of those, I defy you to find a simpler way to explain it. But when you first look at it, you go, it's rotating like this, and you have this thing up at right angle. What are you doing? We sort of have the same thing here, in that I have a surface, and we need to sort of be able to understand things that are tangential and at right angles to the surface throughout this course. So the way that we do that is you imagine, here's the surface, and you imagine that there is a vector, we'll call it, say, the unit normal vector or something, that is pointing outward if it's a closed surface. If it's not a closed surface, then you just sort of choose a direction. And it's at right angles to that surface. And it is what defines, that single vector is what defines the orientation of the surface. It is always at right angles to the surface. All right? And we're going to use it for the first time here. We have our surface A in this case, and we will define its direction by saying there exists a little vector here, which is in the direction normal to A, and I will call it n hat because I don't really want it to have a magnitude. I'm only using it to define the orientation of the surface. And now, if the electric field is coming in like so, and it is coming in normal to that surface, I could sort of which is basically what we were doing up top, I'll rewrite this as phi is equal to the electric field dotted into n hat times A. The electric field and n hat are in the same direction right now, so the dot product becomes the magnitude of the electric field times the magnitude of n hat, which is 1. So the two of them multiplied together is the magnitude of the electric field, and then I multiply that by the area, whatever it is. Okay? Take this same problem, and now I have, let me say that I rotate the surface such that n hat has rotated up an angle theta. So all I've done is the electric field is coming like so. I take the surface and I rotate it like that. When I do that, okay, I have a fixed electric field coming through. As I rotate this, less and less of those electric field lines are going to penetrate the surface, because they penetrate what projects to them, and that projection is getting smaller and smaller. If this is like a window, and I take the window and I turn it at right angles to the wind, no wind gets through, right? The wind only can come through it if I have it at some opening angle. So if we want to really talk about the flux in some general surface, the electric field could encounter that surface at some weird angle. So we have to be able to take care of that. So if the electric field is coming in at some weird angle, so let's say it's just like what we've been drawing, now phi is equal to E dot n hat times A, and let's see if that makes any sense, because what we want to do is to project out that component of the electric field, which is a long end. If the electric field is this way, then E times cosine theta . You can think of the electric field lines here being broken into a component that is this way and a component that is normal to the surface. This is the opening angle between n hat and the electric field line. And so this piece, which is the piece that goes through the surface, is E cosine theta. This is going to be the magnitude of E times the magnitude of A times the cosine of the angle between E and N hat, because that's what you do with thought problems. Did I blast you with this laser? I'm sorry I did. Are you okay with that? I have a cool applet for that one, because it's sort of a pain to visualize. So here's our little surface. I want to calculate the flux. And in this case, I have no electric field strength, so there's no flux. And so you have different views. So you have this sort of view from the side a little bit. You have this view straight on the surface, and you have this view from the front. There's no electric field. What you see here is the normal vector, and the normal vector coming straight out at you. But now if I add some electric field lines in the region, they now pass through the surface, and I've chosen the electric field to have some strength 5. And the area is 3 meters squared, so you can calculate the flux. And the angle theta is 0 in this case. It's the angle between the E-field lines and the normal. You can see there's no angle there. The cosine for that is just 1. And then as I rotate the surface, you can see, for example, that as I rotate the surface to 90 degrees, nothing passes through the surface, and the flux, I didn't quite get it exactly at 90 degrees, so the flux basically goes to 0. One of the things you notice is, suppose I have the flux coming from the other direction. In the example we were just doing, instead of the electric field lines going one way, let's say they're coming the other direction, and I've defined the surface to have a positive end going this way, the E is coming like that. In this picture, I now have rotated it enough that the electric field lines are penetrating through it the other direction. And when that happens, note that the cosine of the angle becomes negative, and in fact, the flux is negative. So it is important to understand that if I have a surface and I define a direction that's positive for that surface, that is a direction of positive impact. It makes a lot of sense if I have a closed surface, which you often will have. Then you think of the positive direction being the direction that's pointing out of the surface, regardless of the shape. But if I have a non-closed surface, then I define a positive direction by just putting my n-hat vector there. And then, if I have electric field lines going in the direction of n-hat, they add in a positive way to the amount of flux going through the surface. If they're going the other direction, then I would call them negative. If I have the same amount of field lines going one way as I do the other way, the total flux through this thing is 0. So even though I have a whole crap load of electric field lines sort of going through it, it could sum up to 0. Okay? This applet is available for your enjoyment on the class website. With all that stuff in mind, we don't deal with simple little windows. We usually have some weird arbitrary potato shapes or something that could be some general shape. So this is some three-dimensional surface that could be very complicated, and now I might have an electric field that is weird and complicated too, varying in strength and direction throughout this thing. Okay, so this would be some general thing. And now what we'd like to know is, what is the flux through the surface? And this now, principle, could be quite hard, because if you look at this surface, for example, if I look at this point, I have a little differential area dA, and it has an n hat that's in that direction. If I'm over here where this one penetrates, I have a little dA this way, and n hat is going like that. Over here, I have my dA like so, and n hat is like that. And notice that the flux for this line, the electric field at this point going through the surface, will be negative here because it's going from outside to in, and it's going to be positive over here. The angle is changing, so if I wanted to calculate flux on the surface, it could be arbitrarily hard. Right? It could be bad. But if I wanted to talk about it in a mathematical sense, for any given spot, any little differential area, any little dA, the differential flux that is going through that little differential area is exactly the same formula we've already had. It's the electric field at that point, whatever it is, dotted into n hat at that point, whatever it is, times the magnitude of the area, which is a differential thing because I have another spot. If this makes sense to you, that's good. And it also means that we have to rewrite it a little because it makes sense to you. So sometimes we take this and instead of calling it an n-hat dA, we call it a little dA vector. So in that case, for example, if I have a dA and I define its direction by this n-hat, sometimes I do the same thing, but I have a little differential area vector, and that little differential area vector is along the direction of n-hat. So sometimes I absorb the area definition into the n-hat. So you'll see it written in different ways. And I will do my best to do it in some arbitrary way, random sense, because I'm not paying any attention. Stop me if you want, but it's a little bit of that as you've got to get used to. So you okay with this? At any given point on here, I have exactly the case that we had on the last page, which is I have an electric field penetrating through a little surface area of this thing. And because everything is changing dramatically, I don't know how to do that, but I do know how to shrink it down to some differential of the piece and write the formula, which is what I have here. And this is exactly what we had on the last page, except for I have differential pieces, and so I have a differential area, a little tiny area, and because it's a differential area, I can't really think of this as a full flux. I think of it as a differential flux, just a little piece of flux. Okay with that? Yes.
How did you get the direction of each of the little?
How do I get the direction?
Kind of perpendicular, but it's a weird shape.
Well, it's a weird shape. So this depends on the details of the shape. And it could be difficult, as we'll see. Okay. It could be easy, so we'll see that. That's actually what we're going to see. All right, so let me assume that I get the flux going through the surface or into the surface, whatever. This has an algebraic sign that varies depending on where you are. And now to get the full flux through the surface, then the full flux going through the surface is equal to this quantity, which is the differential little flux, summed up over the little spots all the way around the surface. So I integrate this over the full surface. There are different ways you can write that. Sometimes I might write surface right here. But another way to do it is to put a little circle here because it looks cool. And maybe I put an S here to signify you're integrating over the surface. So this would represent the sum of the flux through all the little differential areas over the whole surface. Okay? If the surface is complicated and the electric field is complicated, I have no idea how to do that. But for certain geometries, this is very, very doable. Okay? So let's look at one of those geometries. Let's imagine that I have a sphere, a spherical surface. Okay? If I have a spherical surface, then I know that n hat is at right angles to it, which means n hat is pointing out radially everywhere. And let us suppose that I put an electric charge of plus big Q at that point. Now, you know what an electric field looks like for a point charge. It emanates from the point charge and goes out radially like so. And I'm not drawing all the lines, but you get the idea. So if you look at this problem, then the electric field has radial symmetry. And the if you look at the geometry, you will see that wherever those electric field lines encounter the surface, those electric field lines are parallel to NHAB, because NHAB is also always radial. Also, you will notice that if the charge is inside like this one is, the electric field lines all go through the surface in the direction of NHAB. So we would say that the flux is positive, right? So it's going out. So if we want to now calculate the electric flux, then we want to integrate over the surface of the sphere. E dot n hat times dA. In this case, E and n hat are in the same direction, so E dot n hat becomes just the magnitude of E times dA. The magnitude of E, because of the radial symmetry of the problem and the fact that the charge is right at the center of the sphere, every point of the sphere is exactly the same distance away. Therefore, I know what the magnitude of E is from a point. It's k cubed over r squared. So this is equal to k times q over, this is r, over r squared. R isn't changing in this case. The surface is always at a fixed distance. So the electric field is constant on the surface. Sorry, this is times dA. So this is equal to k times q over r squared times the integral over the surface of dA. This is nothing more than the surface area of a sphere, which is 4 pi r squared. And if that's a surprise to you, you want to review basic geometry of spheres and cylinders and things like that, because it is that stuff a lot. So, the flux that we have here, the flux is equal to k times q times 4 pi. If you recall, k is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, so this is equal to q over epsilon naught. You okay with that? Now you'll note that this calculation, which could in principle be arbitrarily difficult, because of the symmetry of this problem, the orientations of the vectors, and what's constant and what's not, the dot product becomes simple, and the electric field is easy to write down, and it's constant and controlled by that integral. So that flux calculation actually not bad. I'm about to show you something, but I'm not going to prove it. Let's suppose we have a charge which is outside some arbitrary surface, or it could be a sphere, could be whatever. And what you'll note is now the flux, it may be radial relative to the charge, but now it's harsh going through the surface from all different directions. Some places it's going in, and some places it's going out. It's going at different angles. Okay, so it's rather complicated. If I have the same thing and I have not got the spherical symmetry, but let's say I have a charge that's in here, could be positive, negative, whatever. And again, I will have electric field lines. And in this case, it could be arbitrarily difficult because of the shape and everything. Without proof, I'm going to tell you, and if you're really interested in it, you can take couple more physics classes and happily work out the proofs yourself. The flux in this case is equal to zero. All I can do is make it sort of plausible to you in the sense that every one of these field lines that is penetrating into the surface here, so it comes in with a negative sign there, and out of the surface here, where it comes with a positive sign. That really doesn't prove this, because the angles and everything can change. So it's not obvious, at least not to me. Here, the net flux is not zero, because you'll note that all of these lines basically are penetrating net positive out of the surface. You could have an instance where a field line here goes out and then back in and then back out, and you could sort of argue it's a net contribution problem. So if the charge is inside the surface, you have a contribution. And interestingly, the flux that you get is equal to the net charge that's inside the surface over epsilon naught. And I'm not proving that to you. Okay? So if you swallow that, then I'm going to present to you a very useful thing to know, which is called Gauss's law. Gauss's law tells us that, well, what I just told you basically, so without proof, Gauss's law says that if I were to integrate the electric field penetrating through a closed surface, this little circle means I am integrating all the way around the surface. I'm summing up the flux through that surface all the way around this closed surface. The electric field dotted into dA, whatever their directions happen to be, no matter how complicated the geometry and how insane it looks, that is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught, where Q enclosed is the net electric charge that is inside that surface, whatever it is. Okay? This law is always true. It is a characteristic of the electric force. It might be arbitrarily difficult to calculate. We've already seen if I had some arbitrary shape, this integral could be really hard to do in practice, depending on how the charge is distributed inside the surface. It could be really hard to calculate, okay? Conceptually, you need to keep this whole thing in mind. What it says is that if I invent a surface, it doesn't matter if it's a sphere, a cube, or whatever. If I have a closed surface, the total flux through that surface is equal to the total charge inside that surface over epsilon naught. So you'll find conceptually sometimes that is really useful. And I will give you a couple of annoying problems which you'll look at and go, what? And then when you get down to it, you'll realize that it's really just a conceptual application of this idea. Okay? It's not really a calculation per se. One of the ways in which you will most use this, though, is for very particular geometries. It turns out that these things are pretty simple to calculate. And when I can calculate them, I'm able to extract the electric field. And that, in the end, is often what we want to do. So therein lies the real utility of Gauss's law, for the most part. So to make that point, what I'd like to do is to go back to that problem that we looked at earlier. This one where the raw calculation of the electric field is just ridiculously hard. So let us suppose that we have a spherical distribution of charge. For simplicity, let me assume that the charge density per unit volume throughout the sphere is equal to a constant. Then the question would be, what is the electric field, let's say, at a point P up here on the z-axis, or down. So what is the electric field at point P, I could ask you. I might ask you, what is the electric field in all space, or everywhere, or something like that. Okay, which sort of sounds a bit worse. And when you get asked something like, you know, here's a problem, what is the electric field everywhere? In that problem, nothing else exists except that thing, whatever it is. And you have to look at it and think about, okay, how do I calculate the field everywhere? Generally speaking, you look at the geometry and it will break up into regions. So what you want to do is calculate the electric field in the different regions. So in this world where I have a sphere of charge, I really have two regions. One is I'm either inside that sphere amongst the charge, or I'm outside that sphere. Okay? From the symmetry of the problem, basically, whatever I calculate for the field at this point P is going to be similar but maybe different in direction from something that is at the same distance away over here. So you can sort of look at the problem and the symmetry of this problem. Imagine this is all positive charge. The symmetry of the problem should tell you immediately that whatever is happening, the electric field is going to have a radial symmetry. Okay. And there's no trick to that. You sort of have to see the symmetry. There's nothing in here that breaks the angular symmetry. If I had exactly the situation and put a little extra charge over here, that wouldn't be true at all. Okay? But in this case, everything has spherical symmetry, so the electric field lines basically have to be radial. They can't be anything else. So then you might say, well, okay, I sort of have a surface defined in this problem, which is the surface of that sphere. The thing is, if I were to use Gauss's law and calculate the electric field on the surface of the sphere, it doesn't really help me that much, because that is just sort of one infinitesimal slice of radial space, okay? So what I really want to do is to try to use Gauss's law in the regions of space where I want to know what the electric field is. And in this problem, I look at it and I have two of those regions of space. One is inside the charge sphere and one is outside the charge sphere. And you look at this and you go, holy crap, there's no surface there. So, but you shouldn't let that stop you. Never let reality get in the way of a good calculation. So what you want to do is invent a surface. So let me do this and turn it into a circle so it's... And now I will put this over here. I think I'll do the outside first. Okay, so what I do is I invent a surface. I'm going to call it a Gaussian surface. And it is totally pulled out of thin air. It does not actually exist. But imagine I have a surface there, and imagine that it is concentric with the center, the same center.
right, concentric with the spherical distribution that I have. And let's say that this, we're given in the problem that this distribution of charge might have a radius big R, and I will invent a surface that has a radius, which I will call little r, and in this case, I'm generally looking at stuff that is outside the sphere. And so I'm constraining little r here to be bigger than big R. So that is, by definition, I'm demanding that this Gaussian surface be outside the charge space. But notice that the way that I've defined it, little r is arbitrary, so long as it's bigger than big R. So it could be right next up to big R. It could be out at infinity. So that means whenever I calculate anything that involves little r, I effectively am getting something that tells me what's going on all the way from big R out to infinity, because little r is variable. So I have chosen an arbitrary little r, which is one of these points, and I'm going to look at the problem. If we look at little r and you imagine that little r is a surface that has n hats, the n hats are all going to be going out radially. From the symmetry of the problem, the electric field lines have to be radial because there's nothing to break that radial symmetry. So you'll note that the electric field lines pretty much have to be going collinear to the n hats all the way around the problem. If I calculate the flux for a surface, the Gaussian surface at r greater than big R, whatever little r is, I calculate it just like I normally do. It's E dot n hat times dA. That's equal to E times dA, because E dot n hat is 1, because E and n hat are in the same direction, so E dot n hat is 1, E dot n hat is equal to magnitude E. So this becomes E times dA. If you look at the radial symmetry of this problem, every point on the surface of the Gaussian surface is at exactly the same distance from the center of this spherical charge distribution. So the electric field magnitude from the symmetry of the problem has to be the same everywhere on that Gaussian surface. Because of that, as I sum up over the Gaussian surface doing this integral, this thing is constant. So it pulls out of the integral. So this is equal to E times the integral of dA, and this is the surface area of the sphere. But the sphere that we're talking about now, remember this Gaussian flux calculation we're doing, we've chosen the Gaussian surface, which is this orange thing, and so that lies at a distance little r, which means that this is equal to pi r squared would be the area of a surface out at radius little r. Okay? If I consider this Gaussian surface, we know that the total flux going through that surface is equal to the total charge that is inside that surface divided by epsilon naught, because that's basically Gaussian threshold of order. So the flux I also know to be equal to Q net divided by epsilon naught. And so that's equal to the magnitude of E times 4 pi r squared. Okay? Q net is the integral over the volume of the sphere of rho dV. We'll talk about how to do that, but here I don't think we actually have to do an integral, because the total charge, if I have a constant rho across this distribution, is going to be that rho times the volume of the sphere with radius big R, right? That's the sphere in which there is charge. So it will be 4/3 pi big R cubed times rho, which is a constant. So then I can solve for the electric field. The magnitude of the electric field at R greater than big R is going to be equal to 4/3 pi big R cubed. So that would be, in this case, divided by epsilon naught. I'm solving for this. And then I divide by 4 pi little r squared. If we want to calculate rho, rho is going to be equal to whatever the total charge is divided by the volume, 4/3 pi big R cubed. So I can rewrite this as Q over 4 pi epsilon r squared. You may recognize the 1 over 4 pi epsilon, that's epsilon naught, as k. So this is equal to k q over little r squared. So even though I have a charge that is in the shape of a sphere, an extended sphere, the ones on the outside of that sphere, it turns out that the electric field looks exactly like it would if I had all of that charge at a point in the center. It falls off as k q over r squared. And it's radial. So I wrote here the absolute magnitude. I wrote, you know, the magnitude of E. If the question is asking you, what is E, you now have to write the magnitude and then tell the direction. So in this case, it would be, you know, R hat, positive R hat. Okay? We just calculated the electric field at the point P outside of the sphere, which is the problem that looked so thorny earlier. In that case, it's along the radial line, so it's up along the direction Z. Depending on where P is, it falls, you know, it's the distance R away from the center, and that would be the magnitude of the electric field. Okay? It's a lot easier than that phony spherical triple integral. So we've just calculated the electric field in all space from R equal big R out to infinity. Okay? Pretty cool. Now what we want to do is to calculate it inside the sphere. So I choose a Gaussian surface that has a radius that is inside the sphere. And now I've chosen it at some arbitrary little r. So if I calculate the electric field at that surface, I will have a mathematical formula that gives me the electric field everywhere from little r equals 0 to little r equals big R, which is the inside of the sphere. We also now call that a Gaussian surface. But in this case, we demand that it be for R less than big R. Just like last time, the symmetries are all the same. N hat is radial. Even though you're inside and there is charge outside this surface, there's nothing to violate the radial symmetry. So the electric field is going to be radially outward. You can imagine that the stuff that is outside the little radius R, this stuff, that doesn't contribute, because we sort of said that if I have charge outside the surface, its contribution to the net flux is 0. Okay? So when you're summing the flux up along this surface, you don't even consider this stuff. You only consider what's inside to get the flux. So to calculate the flux, that's equal to the integral over the surface now at R, which is less than big R, of E dot N hat times dA.
Both E and N hat are in the radial direction. They're parallel to the dot product between the magnitude of E. Because of the spherical symmetry of the problem, E has to have the same magnitude at every point on that surface, so it pulls out of the integral. And I have the magnitude of E times the integral of dA. The integral of dA is the sum of the surface area of that sphere, which is 4 pi little r squared. So this thing becomes equal to the magnitude of E at little r times 4 pi little r squared, using all the same arguments that we used earlier. This, by Gauss's law, is also equal to Q enclosed divided by epsilon naught. In order to calculate that piece of it, which I need, right, what I now have here from how flux is defined, basically, and we calculate it, I have here an expression that involves the magnitude of E as a function of little r. And now I want to set that equal to something so that I can solve for whatever the magnitude of E is. So I use Gauss's law, and I set this equal to the Q enclosed over epsilon naught. Q enclosed represents the charge that is inside the Gaussian surface. So it represents the charge that is inside this surface. So the charge that is inside that surface is going to be equal to rho, which is constant throughout, times the volume of that sphere. So it'll be rho times 4/3 pi little r cubed divided by epsilon naught. So now I can take this piece and set that equal to what we just got for Q enclosed over epsilon naught. And that piece is E times 4 pi r squared. So that means that the magnitude of E for r less than big R
is equal to rho over epsilon naught times 4/3 pi little r cubed over 4 pi little r squared, or rho over epsilon naught times 3 rho r over epsilon naught divided by 3. Rho we could rewrite as, how do we do that? That would be q over 4/3 pi big R cubed. Doesn't matter however you want it. Good. If you write it this way, the 3's cancel, I get the 4 pi epsilon naught, so I have k q r. Over big R cubed. So you can rewrite it any of those ways. Again, if you ask for the electric field, you have to get the direction to the radiant and outgoing of this thing. If you are outside the sphere, so you're out here, the field is dropping off as 1 over r squared, just as if all of this charge was at a point. If you're inside the sphere, okay, so I'm in here, as you go out in R, you're getting more and more charge inside. And that charge is growing as the radius grows as a 4/3 pi R cubed. So you're adding charge a lot as you go in. So you get a different relationship. And in this case, what we find is that the electric field strength is growing, not falling off, but it is growing in strength linearly in R. Maybe a way to think of it is the field is falling off as 1 over R squared if you were to think of the charge just inside, but as you now grow in R, you're adding a cube. You're adding more and more charge in there as a function of the cube, so those two things sort of cancel each other out to the point where it grows as a function of little r. So you might look at the relationship of this thing. You might look at, so E is radial, and you can look at the magnitude of E as a function of where you are. And let's say there's little r. And outside of the sphere, this falls off as 1 over r squared. But inside the sphere, it grows linearly with r. Any questions? It's not a greater electric field inside than out. It's just as you go out in R, it's growing linearly. So if you look, for example, the field inside and the field outside have to come to the same value on the surface. And you'll note that for most all the inside here, the field is smaller than it is at that value outside. So it's just it grows linearly with R as you go in, it falls off there as R squared. All right, so the gotchas in this. The gotchas are as follows. You get to something like this, and you're calculating the charge that's inside the sphere. You have to remember, you're calculating the charge inside the Gaussian surface. So that means you have to use this little r when you calculate that volume. If you don't think for a moment and you use the big R, it's wrong. It's the wrong charge. So generally speaking, the easiest way to screw up these problems is to lose track of which surface you're actually talking about. Okay? So that's the thing I want you to keep in mind as you practice doing this problem. So what I will do for you mostly next week,
somewhat more complicated problem for this. We're going to allow the row to change, and we're also going to look at the different geometries where this is useful. It's particularly useful for spherical problems, cylindrical problems, or certain planar problems. And so now I'm going to take you through those. So, all right. Have a good week.